So this session, we're going to move on to talk about meditation. And in particular, we're going to look at the different types of meditation, and then we're going to be focusing on one of the core foundational practices this session and the next session as well. So meditation, again, terminology, to be clear, is coming from the Sanskrit word bhavana. And bhavana literally means to cultivate, to familiarize. So meditation is about cultivating, familiarizing ourselves. And so, of course, what we're talking about here is cultivating positive states of mind, cultivating an insight into reality, and then familiarizing ourselves with that. So this is really what meditation is about. Now, of course, there are many different types of meditation, and there are many ways of dividing up meditation into different categories. The one that is normally presented, particularly within Tibetan Buddhism, is to divide all meditation into two categories. And the two categories is stabilizing meditation and analytical meditation. So stabilizing meditation, as the name sort of suggests, is simply meditation to stabilize our mind, to simply develop a calm, clear, focused mind. So stabilizing meditation is all about developing our attention skills, developing our ability to focus. And this stabilizing meditation, in Buddhism, generally is called concentration practice. Concentration in Sanskrit is samadhi. So samadhi just means concentration. And within the Buddhist spiritual path, we can cultivate many different levels of samadhi are possible. The one that is very much emphasized within the Mahayana Buddhist traditions is a level of concentration in Sanskrit called shamatha. So shamatha is a particular level of concentration we are to cultivate, and it is the minimum level of concentration we need to cultivate to have a stable and clear enough mind to be able to penetrate the nature of reality directly. If we want to have a direct experience of the nature of reality, we need a very stable and clear mind. We need the mind of shamatha. So therefore, when we talk about the concentration practice, we often talk about cultivating shamatha. Now, shamatha, the word shamatha, we can divide into two parts. Shama literally means calm, a mind that's not discursive, not moving around. And ta means to remain, to abide. And so this is translated often as abiding. So shamatha practice in English is often called calm abiding practice, to develop this calm abiding. So basically, we're developing this single point of concentration, this calm, clear, focused mind. Because if we don't have a stable mind, then all the other meditation practices are not going to work very well. You know, same with everything in our life. If our mind is very unstable, we're not effective in doing anything. So similarly, shamatha practice or stabilizing meditation is the basis of analytical meditation. And analytical meditation, as the name suggests, is we are analyzing, we're investigating something. And there are many, many different types of analytical meditations that we can do. Again, within Buddhism, in this area, we often talk about the two main aspects, which are like the two wings of the bird, which is wisdom and compassion. So the two core areas of analytical type of meditation is developing wisdom, developing compassion. Wisdom here, another word for wisdom in Sanskrit is vipassana. Although probably most of you are more familiar with the Pali word vipassana. And both in the Sanskrit word vipassana and the Pali word vipassana, the VI part of the word means higher or superior. And passana or passana means to see. So vipassana practice is superior seeing, higher seeing, seeing beyond. So often then vipassana or vipassana is translated into insight. And often the VI is translated as higher or special. So you see often that vipassana or vipassana is often translated as special insight, or sometimes just insight, gaining insight into the nature of reality. Because again, from the Buddhist perspective, that's the root of all of our problems, of our suffering, is we have a false, distorted view of reality. So the wisdom practice, sometimes called the vipassana or vipassana practice, is about gaining insight into reality. And the other main core type of analytical meditation is the compassion wing. And in the compassion wing, often we talk about cultivating four core qualities. The first is loving kindness. Loving kindness is the wish for ourselves and others to have happiness and its causes. The second one, closely related to that, is actual compassion itself, which is the wish for ourselves and others to be free of suffering and its causes. The third quality is called empathetic joy. This is a rejoicing in our own and others' virtue and good deeds. And the fourth one is equanimity. Which is this equal attitude towards others, a sense of closeness to everyone. Because now we don't have equanimity, we tend to be very biased in the way we interact with people. And we often interact with people in terms of those people around us who seem to be supporting me in my happiness, we often have a lot of attachment to them. And those people around us who don't seem to be affecting me and my happiness in any way, we often have a lot of indifference and apathy towards them. And those people around us who seem to be interfering with me and my happiness, maybe even trying to cause me suffering, we have a lot of aversion, hostility, anger, and hatred. So we end up with attachment to friends, apathy to strangers, hostility, anger, and hatred to difficult people. So equanimity is about overcoming that bias. So it's about understanding that we're all stuck in the same situation. We're all struggling to be happy, to be free of suffering, to have a sense of closeness to everyone in that respect. So this is what equanimity means. So these are four core qualities we are trying to cultivate in the compassion wing of this analytical meditation practice. So, of course, there are lots of other types of analytical meditations, but these are really the two core components of analytical practice. So what we can understand is that if we don't work on stabilizing our mind as a basis, we can put a lot of effort into compassion practice, vipassana practice, and not really get anywhere, because our mind is just caught up in dullness and distraction. So this is the basis for this. Now, with these two core practices in the analytical meditation, we need to cultivate them together. Because unfortunately what happens often is when it comes to these sort of meditation, people tend to gravitate to one or the other. You know, often people hear that, I need wisdom if I want to get out of this mess. So they put a lot of effort into Vipassana practice and they sort of forget about this. Because even sometimes in Buddhist texts it says, if you achieve this wisdom, this will come spontaneously. That may be true, but there's no way you're going to get this without working on this at the same time. In fact, what happens here often is people who engage in this type of practice without doing any of this, often people become very self-absorbed, become completely disconnected with the world, and often become very insensitive to the sufferings of others. And often, if people are doing a lot of this in depth, they become a bit delusional. They think, I'm some high-level Vipassana practitioner, so everything I do is with wisdom, which means everything I do is okay. And they end up doing completely unethical things, saying, but I'm doing it through wisdom. You know, sometimes we hear this thing, crazy wisdom. So they say, I'm doing crazy wisdom, and they are completely unethical. So this is a big mess. So we need to make sure that we are balancing. But at the same time, sometimes people are naturally drawn to compassion and they just try to be a good person and they don't develop this. Usually a big mess. Really. Because what happens is that their compassion can be completely biased. As I just mentioned, yes, I'll be compassionate to these people because they're nice people. I'll help them. These are horrible, nasty people. I'm not going to be compassionate. They deserve to suffer. So our compassion can become very biased. And then, of course, also, we may have the best intention in the world to help, but sometimes we don't know what to do and we make a big mess and we create more suffering than was there before. So that's compassion without wisdom as well. But also what can happen is particularly people who have very strong motivation, compassion and motivation, want to go out and fix and heal the world, full of enthusiasm. You know, we see this in like social workers, aid workers. I want to make a difference, fix the world. So they jump out there full of enthusiasm, and then usually 3 to 6 months later, compassion burnout. Compassion without wisdom. Because here we need the wisdom of understanding how we can help, how we can't help, and definitely the wisdom of knowing when to rest and look after ourselves. So compassion burnout, classic example of compassion without wisdom. And unfortunately, the problem is when this compassion burnout happens, people don't realize that it's actually the wisdom that's missing. They think compassion doesn't work and they give up because, you know, the result is I'm completely burnt out. So then, and I didn't fix the world. So therefore, compassion doesn't work. Let's just give it up. That's a tragedy. What's not working is the wisdom is missing. It's not like compassion doesn't work. It's not effective. Then, of course, there's one other thing, and we've probably all experienced this many occasions, is we try to help someone, and then they take advantage of us. Compassion without wisdom. So if we allow people to take advantage of us, that's not very compassionate, because we're encouraging them to behave badly. That's not compassion. Compassion is trying to benefit people. So if someone's trying to take advantage of us, we need to be very firm about that. That's wisdom in compassion. So we need to make sure that we don't allow that to happen. But again, what happens is, unfortunately, people try to help, they get taken advantage of, and they go, compassion doesn't work, I give up. It's not compassion doesn't work, it's you don't have the wisdom there to make it work. So that's what we need to understand. So therefore, we need both of these together. Otherwise, we end up in all sorts of problems.
I was just going to say, talk about a story that happened earlier in my life where I was trying to do something good with absolutely no wisdom at all, and it completely backfired and was a complete mess.
Yeah.
There was a homeless person in Ulverston, and when I was a teenager, I used to see him all the time, and he would just be sat on the street, you know, even in the rain, he'd just be sat there. And one day my mum said, oh, it was like a special day in Buddhism today, and it's like one of the multiplying days, you know, where all the karmas, like, magnified, right? And I was like, all right, okay, so like, I better do something good today. And then I remembered this tramp. I thought, I'm going to make him a really nice packed lunch, So I made him some really nice sandwiches and got some crisps and like a little thing of juice. And I know that he smoked cigarettes, so I got him like a pack of cigarettes as well and put them in there. And then I went up to him and I was like, "How you doing, mate? Today's like a really special day in my religion, and I just wanted to give you this." And he was like, "Don't talk to me about religion." I was like, "No, I've made you some lunch." He was like, "Get away from me." And I was like, "Come on, look, I've made you some nice sandwiches." And then like he got up and started walking down the street, and then I was like following him from this thing. And then I just thought, I better leave him. That's it.
Yeah.
And it was just a real nightmare.
Yeah. But the problem is that often when people do this, they don't really understand that maybe they don't know what to do, but they don't understand. They often feel like, oh, compassion's not working. Let's just give up on the compassion.
Mm-hmm.
But it's actually just what's not working is that the wisdom is missing. Maybe it's difficult to know what the wisdom was there, but...
And I said, well, until they're ready to stop their own suffering, then I think it is compassionate to help them because they'll could do something far worse to get the money.
Yeah.
Or the people will come in and look that we shouldn't do that.
Yeah. I mean, the bottom line is with things like this, it's difficult to know, but we at the minimum is we need to try to use this. If we don't try to use this, then definitely it's going to be probably worse. So yes, there's no book you can go to that says do this. This is the right thing, you know, because every situation is on its own merit. But within any given situation, all we can do is use the most compassion, the most wisdom we have, and act. That's all we can do. And if we demand to know, is this the right thing to do? We're never going to do anything. We're just going to be stuck because we're not going to be sure. So that's all we can do in any situation is use as much of that and much of that as we got. Act, and then if we make a mistake, we learn from that and we improve our wisdom. That's all we can do. Okay. Now, what I'd like to do is what we've seen here is that shamatha is the basis of all the analytical meditations, particularly the core practices of wisdom and compassion. So what I'd like to do now for this session and the next session is look at this practice because... it's a core element of all Buddhist traditions. In all Buddhist traditions, they say this is one of the core practices. But unfortunately, what we see in the modern world is when you look at the individual traditions in Buddhism and see what they're actually doing, this seems to get left out. You know, you look at a lot of the Theravada traditions and they all talk about vipassana. Let's do vipassana. And then you look at the Tibetan tradition, they talk about a lot about the compassion, the bodhicitta, emptiness, deity, yoga. I mean, all good practices, but if these practices don't have this as a basis, you can spend years doing deity, yoga, emptiness, bodhicitta, and not really go anywhere. So, therefore, we need to make sure that this is the basis. We need to put effort into this, particularly... if we find that we're the sort of person that's not very well focused, and that, I think, accounts for most of us in our modern society. And what you will find is that not only is the shamatha practice the basis of all the other practices, but if we just do the shamatha practice as a core element, a lot of immediate benefit in our daily life as well. Because a lot of our difficulties in daily life are coming from a lack of mindfulness, you know. We're not effective in the things we do. We're caught up in a lot of stress, a lot of distraction, a lot of agitation. And if we can put a lot of effort into shamatha practice, what you will notice directly in daily life is you'll become more calm, more focused, more effective, less stress. And often that translates into better health. And also what you'll find is that you'll start to enjoy the simple pleasures in life much more than you do now. So there are a lot of direct benefits for the shamatha practice, let alone, of course, the deeper level of benefit in terms of basis for wisdom, compassion practice. So what I'd like to do now then is look at how to practice this shamatha practice. So let's have a look at the actual meditation practice, what we are to do. So within the actual meditation practice, we can talk about two parts, preparation and the actual meditation. Preparation is important. Preparation is what we do at the beginning of a meditation session to prepare ourselves well for the practice. Unfortunately, a lot of people either put little effort here or no effort. They just skip it and go straight into the meditation, and usually then not so well. In preparation, we can talk about preparing ourselves in three aspects, three ways. We can talk about preparing body, speech, and mind. Preparing the body, of course, is talking about the posture. So there's a lot of talk about how to set up a good posture. We won't go through all the details, but just to mention some of the key elements. And I already mentioned that in the previous meditation, that in terms of posture, two key elements. One is to keep the back straight, because if we don't have a straight back, if we're sort of hunched over like this, then we're just going to get dull. So keep the back nice and straight, and also with the back straight, from a Buddhist perspective, the subtle energies in our body will flow better. If we're sort of hunched over, they're a bit more constricted, that's also going to cause some difficulties. So keeping the back straight, and the other thing together with that is the body completely relaxed. Completely relaxed, because we often have a lot of tension in the body. So therefore, make sure that the body is completely relaxed, back straight. Just a few things on the posture. With the legs, of course, if we're sitting on a cushion, then often recommended the full lotus is the most stable. You know, both feet on the other opposite thighs. Most of us find that very difficult because we're not used to sitting like that. Then you can try what's called half lotus. You have one foot on a thigh and the other one underneath. Probably many of us find that very difficult. So then just cross-legged. Often with cross-legged posture, people find that they cut circulation off, their leg goes numb or something. Play around with that, but if that you can't get it working there, what another alternative to that is what's called the Burmese posture, where you have one leg in front of the other, not cross them. One in front of the other, and you'll find that can also be helpful. Just have one in front of the other. If you're sitting cross-legged, it's important to have stability. So often we're very stiff in the hips and knees, and usually we sit on a very small cushion, and then we're sort of knees are sticking up in the air, and we're sort of like wobbling all over the place, and we have a lot of strain on the lower back. So that's not going to be very helpful. So if we're very stiff in the hips and knees, add more cushions. You know, maybe you can even have like this much to sit so that the knees are at least level with the hips, ideally if the knees are touching, because then you have three points of contact and very stable. So use more cushions. And another sign that you don't have enough cushions is if you're always straightening the back. You know, you're always doing this and you end up with a lot of pain in the lower back. That's a sure sign we're very stiff. We need to sit on more cushions. So keep jacking up the cushions so that the back is naturally straight and you're not straining the lower back. So if you're very stiff like I was when I started and still am quite a lot, I mean, I think I was sitting on cushions like about like that. It was almost like a throne, you know. But at least when I was sitting that high on cushions, my knees were sort of down, touching the cushions, and my back was naturally straight. So that's the key. Some people have knee problems, find sitting cross-legged is too painful. So then we can use like a meditation stool, you know, a little stool where you tuck the legs underneath. So that can be very helpful as well. Some people find that even that is not comfortable. So then we can sit in a chair like we're doing here. With sitting in a chair, and probably most chairs you'll need an adjustment, is the back of the chair is so that we sort of slouch a bit in it. So if you're sitting in a chair, you may need to put like a cushion in behind your back here so that the back stays straight. Otherwise, you may find you sort of end up hunching in the chair. So if you're going to use a chair, then probably you go, and there, you sometimes see people, you get these little foam inserts that you can stick in the back here to support the back. So you may find one of those are helpful to keep the back straight, or if you've got an adjustable chair, you may adjust it so it's more vertical so you really can keep the back straight. Some people find that they've got back problems, sitting in a chair is a problem. Then what we can do if we've got back problems is lie down. Completely okay. So you lie down in what's called the Shavasana, the corpse posture, flat on your back, hands to the side, upward, legs a little bit apart, and just in that posture. So there, of course, the back is very straight, the body's completely relaxed. Now, when I was introduced to this corpse posture for meditation some years ago, I thought, well, that's not going to work. I'm just going to get sleepy and fall asleep. And sure enough, the first few times I did it. I got very drowsy and... But then I found that as I got used to using this posture only for meditation, I actually could use then and stay alert. And now I use it a lot. I just did recently an 8-week retreat with Alan Wallace, and half of my sessions each day was in the corpse posture. And I found it very, very helpful. Particularly if you're doing a retreat and you're sitting many hours, you start to get sore knees, sore hips, you get a bit fatigued, lie down. Really lie down. It's very comfortable, and if you get used to using that posture for meditation, you can really stay quite alert and be completely relaxed. Particularly if you find you have a lot of tension in the body and you're sitting upright, you can't release the tension, lie down. Get relaxed. Hopefully, if we can manage it, we're going to try and do one of these meditations today in the last session, just to sort of get used to it. I don't know if we've got enough cushions available or mats.
I think Mary's going to bring some of those.
Okay, so we're going to actually then do that meditation in the last session today, because what I found personally, and also even in the last 8-week retreat, so many people are very tight and tense, and we're too goal-oriented. So when we sit down to meditate, we sort of push too hard and the body tenses, whereas if we're lying down, it's much more relaxed. So we're going to try that this afternoon, and I can really thoroughly recommend it. So that's a little bit the body. Preparing the speech. Here we're not talking about verbal speech, we're talking about mental chatter. In particular, preparing the speech here, what's often recommended is that if we are coming into a meditation with a little bit of a negative, agitated state of mind, and we sit down, it's hard to get out of that state into a positive state of mind. So what we can do as part of preparing speech is we start by doing a little breathing exercise. And that can take a number of forms. In the Tibetan tradition, often you find this what's called 9-round breathing exercise, and often involves a lot of elaborate visualization. We don't really need to do that, but it can be part of it. Some traditions simply say count 21 breaths. Some traditions just say focus on doing three deep breaths. So all of those breathing exercises at the beginning of a practice all have the same purpose. By focusing on the breath, you can let go of any negativity and bring the mind into a neutral state. So often it's helpful at the beginning of your meditation, once you've sat down and relaxed the body, particularly if you notice some agitation or negative state of mind, do a little breathing exercise to focus on that, to bring your mind into a neutral state, and then move forward from there. Then, of course, particularly if you do a breathing exercise, but in general, recommended to let the breath flow naturally. Often the temptation can be, particularly in shamatha practice, is to manipulate the breath. You know, oh, I need to make my breath rhythmic, I need to make it deep, I need to make it subtle, so let's do that. And so people try to do that and it's a big mess. You know, because after some time they try and make their breath more and more subtle, and then all of a sudden they go, and they have to gasp because they're running short on breath. So we don't want to do that. So in this and all meditations, it's just let the breath do its own thing. Of course, there are specific practices, things like pranayama, where you're doing breath manipulation for a particular purpose. That's okay. But here, we're not doing that type of meditation. So in this shamatha practice, just let the breath do whatever it wants. Don't try to control or manipulate in any way. Then, in terms of preparing the mind, we can talk about two things. One is to make sure we have a positive motivation. And the second is to bring the mind into the present moment. Because again, often in the beginning of a meditation, we're stuck in the past and the future. You know, either we're sort of going back in the past, or more commonly in this sort of meditation is, oh, I wonder how my meditation's going to go. I hope it does this. Oh, I hope I'm not distracted. You know, and so we're jumping into the future. We're full of expectation, maybe some fear, worry, anxiety about the meditation. Disaster. So we need to make sure that we're not living in the past. We're not anticipating the future, in particular about expectation, hope, fear for the practice, because that will derail your whole practice. So we need to let go of those and bring the mind into the present moment. So if we bring the mind into the present moment, then we can, with a good motivation, we can effectively start the shamatha practice. So these are some elements of preparation. And we're going to do a short shamatha meditation where we emphasize preparation. Now, preparation is very important. And often people either skip it or do it very quickly because they want to do the real practice. And then they jump into the practice and their mind is agitated, tense, and just doesn't work. So we don't want to shortchange ourselves on not doing enough preparation. You may find in some of your meditation sessions you need to prepare longer, some shorter, but make sure you don't cut it short. Make sure that we get to that point of relaxation, being present, positive motivation, then we can effectively start. You may find actually some meditation sessions, maybe you need to sort of prepare yourself most of the session. That's okay. Some sessions may be a few minutes and you can get yourself going. But again, make sure that you don't cut it short. Otherwise, the actual practice, you're going to find a lot of difficulty.
Glenn, where would you put the refuge, bodhicitta, motivational prayers before I start? Would that come in this part?
Right. I would recommend if we are... depends how we do that. If we're actually, verbally talking, I would do that before you actually start
sitting.
Well, you can be sitting down, but the very first thing you do is do that. Okay. Then you go through the whole thing. If it's a more mental thing, you're just mentally refuge bodhicitta, we can do that here. Yeah, because otherwise that sort of verbal visual speaking is quite active. And then we need to settle down. I mean, it's good for setting motivation. But also what you may find is that what happens is people, if they have that, often they think, okay, let's just parrot off these verses quickly. And they tick, done, go. And then nothing goes in.
Yeah.
So it's not a matter of, yes, I need to read these refuge bodhicitta prayer three times.
It's using it to spark
motivation. I mean, if you're in a group, it could be useful to do that verbally to get the group energy. But I think if you're doing it at home yourself, I think it could be counterproductive to just keep reading it, because then your switch often becomes mechanical. You just go, blah, 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 blah. Okay, let's go.
Yeah.
Whereas if you don't have that and you have to do it mentally, it sort of forces you to think about it.
Yeah.
So then you can do it at this point, because then you're more there. So it depends a little bit how you're doing it. So again, it's not that, yes, we have to read out these verses three times. The important thing is what's happening in the mind, not what's going through the mouth. Yeah. You know, like the very famous text, one that I teach from Panchen Losang Chögyi Gyaltsen, Panchen Lama, first Panchen Lama. He's talking about refuge and bodhicitta and the importance of doing this at the beginning. He said, make sure you do it so it's not merely words from your mouth. And so that's easy. If you've got prayers there, it's so easy just to switch the mind off and just go, I go for refuge to Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, blah, blah, may I achieve enlightenment for the benefit of others. I mean, it's easy to mouth the words and nothing shifts. So again, the important thing is not that you read the words accurately. The important thing is what's happening in your mind, you know. Are you really... So that's the key. So therefore, I think it's actually better not to do that. I mean, in a group, it can be helpful because you get the sort of the group energy. But if you're doing it by yourself at home, I mean, those verses you can memorize.
Yeah.
And so then just mentally do that.
Internally. Yeah, so just say, why am I actually doing this?
Exactly. And sometimes it's better not to do those verses because, again, you can just mentally do that and it has no effect. it can just become some sort of rote thing, you know, that you're doing just because that's what you do. And so I would mix it up. And like you said, sometimes don't do the verses and just sit there and go, why am I doing this meditation? And think about that, really. And not just go, oh, it's for the benefit of others, for enlightenment, and, you know. Otherwise, it can become very just, you know, just blah, 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 you know. Okay, so what we're going to do now then, before we break for lunch, is we're going to do a short shamatha practice. Particularly, I want to emphasize the preparation part, so we have that clear. And then in the actual meditation, we're just going to go in a very simple shamatha practice. We're just going to focus on sensations, like we did a little bit in the previous meditation. Just focus on the sensations of the breath anywhere in the body where you notice, you know. And it could be in the abdomen, the stomach, chest area. Whenever you breathe, just notice any sensations associated with breath in a very relaxed way. And in this particular meditation, we're just really emphasizing relaxation. So just really emphasize a relaxed body and a relaxed mind, because this is going to be the basis of successful shamatha practice. We're going to talk more about that in the after lunch, but that's what we're going to do now. So if there's not any more questions about that, we'll jump into the meditation now. Okay. So as always, we begin by preparing the body. So simply allow your awareness to descend into the body. And simply become aware of sensations throughout the body. And use the out-breath to relax and release any tightness or tension in any part of the body. And again, bring your awareness to the area of your face, softening and relaxing all the muscles in the face. All the muscles around the eyes, soft and relaxed. this way allowing the entire body to become completely relaxed, completely at ease. And at the same time, keeping the back nice and straight. And relaxing more deeply with every out-breath. Then we can take three slow, deep breaths, maintaining awareness of sensations throughout the body as you breathe. And then simply allow the breathing to settle into its natural rhythm. Not trying to control or regulate the breath in any way. And with each out-breath, letting go of any thoughts that may have arisen, happily releasing them. Letting go of any hopes or fears, worries or concerns about the past or the future. In particular, letting go of any expectations for this meditation. And simply allow the mind to come to rest in the present moment. And then briefly think about your motivation for doing this meditation. In particular, you might like to reflect on the benefits of cultivating a calm, clear, and focused mind. And now simply become aware of sensations throughout the body associated with the breath. And maintain an ongoing flow of mindfulness of the sensations of the breath throughout the body. Wherever you most distinctly notice any sensations associated with the breath. And if you find that your mind has become distracted, then there's no need to get upset. Rather, the first thing to do is simply relax. Then to release the distraction, let go of it, and very gently return to focusing on the breath. So relax, release, and return. Every time you become distracted, simply keep coming back. where we can slowly finish the meditation. Does anyone have any questions about that practice or anything we've just talked about before we break for lunch?
Three
hours. We're going to talk more about this practice, the details of the practice, in the next session, and particularly on this point that you've just mentioned. It's a very important point, because often people get very frustrated, and one of the reasons people get frustrated with this practice is completely unrealistic expectations. Often people who've never really meditated, particularly this shamatha type of practice, live in the illusion or delusion that their mind is sort of okay. You know, focus on the breath. Oh, that shouldn't be too difficult. Yeah, I might get a bit dull or distracted, but I think I can do that okay. And of course, when we get into the practice and we find that it's not that easy and we're constantly distracted, the tendency can be two things. One, we get completely upset. You know, I can't meditate. I give up. And the second one is, unfortunately, what we do on top of that, and that's what we do tend to do in daily life, is, and we mentioned it briefly already, is that when we want to focus on something in daily life, what do? We tense. Because we know our minds are chaotic. If we don't tense, somehow we won't be able to focus. So we get distracted and we think, oh, the problem is I wasn't enough focused, enough tense. I need to tense more. So what we do is we come back even more tense than before. And of course, that just agitates the mind even more. So it's a self-fulfilling prophecy of agitation and distraction doing that. So that's why in those three R's, the first thing is when we find we're distracted, don't get upset. In fact, we should be happy that we've noticed that we're distracted, not get upset that we've distracted. So we'd be happy we notice we got distracted, and the first thing to do is just relax, not this automatic tension. And then just let go of the distraction and come back. And just keep doing that. Because we're just trying to strengthen mindfulness. And one of the very nice quotes from a great Indian master, Shantideva, who's quoted a lot, one of his quotes from his famous text, he says, no matter how difficult something seems, everything with practice becomes easy. And it's true in everything in our life. You know, we look at something difficult and we go, oh, no, it's too difficult. But we keep practicing, and then it comes easy. Same with this. You know, if we just keep doing it, practicing, it will become easy. So rather than getting frustrated and upset, we just need to practice. If we practice, we'll become proficient. That's all we need to do. Any other questions? Otherwise, we'll break for lunch.
Relax, release,
and then return.
Okay,
let's break for lunch. We've got an hour for lunch, so we'll come back at 1:30. And we'll go look at this practice in more detail, and then we'll go back into the practice again. Do a little bit more deep